Welcome back. You're listening to Across the Border, our Prophecy Reality Edition. And in this segment, we are going to continue our series on the shadow government works for the Antichrist. And this is Chapter 8, Diffusion of the Jesuits Throughout Christendom. And of course, this is a 500-year-old plan set in motion by the Antichrist through his Jesuit army. That's Chapter 8, Diffusion of the Jesuits Throughout Christendom. The soldiers of Loyola are about to go forth. Before beginning the campaign, we see their head assembling them and pointing out the field on which their prowess is to be displayed. The nations of Christendom are in revolt. It will be theirs to subjugate them once more, bound in chains at the feet of the papal see. They must not faint. The arms he has provided them with are amply sufficient for the arduous warfare on which he sends them. Clad in that armor and wielding it in the way he has shown them, they will expel knowledge as night chases away the day. Liberty will die wherever their foot shall tread, and in the ancient darkness they will be able to raise again the fallen throne of the great hierarch of Rome. But if the service is hard, the wages will be ample. As the saviors of that throne, they will be greater than it. And though meanwhile their work is to be done in great show of humility and poverty, the silver and the gold of Christendom will in the end be theirs. They will be the lords of its lands and palaces, the masters of the bodies and souls of its inhabitants, and nothing of all that the heart can desire will be withheld from them, only if they will obey him. The Jesuits rapidly multiplied, and we are now to follow them in their peregrinations over Europe. Going forth in little bands, animated with an entire devotion to their general, schooled in all the arts which could help to further their mission, they planted themselves in a few years in all the countries of Christendom and made their presence felt in the turning of the tide of Protestantism, which till then had been on the flow. There was no disguise they could not assume, and therefore there was no place into which they could not penetrate. They could enter unheard the closet of the monarch or the cabinet of the statesman. They could sit unseen in convocation or general assembly and mingle unsuspected in the deliberations and debates. There was no tongue they could not speak, no creed they could not profess, and thus there was no people among whom they would not sojourn, and no church whose membership they might not enter, and whose functions they might not discharge. They could execrate the Pope with the Lutheran, and swear the solemn league with the Covenanter. They had their men of learning and eloquence for the halls of nobles and the courts of kings, their men of science and letters for the education of youth, their unpolished but ready orators to harangue the crowd, and their plain unlettered monks to visit the cottages of the peasantry and the workshops of the artisan. "I know these men," said Joseph II of Austria, writing to Choiseul, Prime Minister of Louis XV. "I know these men as well as anyone can do. All the schemes they have carried on, and the plans they have taken to spread darkness over the earth, as well as their efforts to rule and embroil Europe from Cape Finisterre to Spitsbergen. In China, they were mandarins. In France, academics, courtiers, and confessors. In Spain and Portugal, grandees. In Paraguay, kings. Had not my granduncle, Joseph I, become emperor, we had in all probably seen in Germany, too, a Malagrida or an Averroes, in order that they might be at liberty to visit what city and diocese they pleased. they were exempted from episcopal jurisdiction. They could come and go at their pleasure and perform all their functions without having to render account to anyone save their superior. This arrangement was resisted at first by certain prelates, but it was universally conceded at last, and it greatly facilitated the wide and rapid diffusion of the Jesuit corps. Extraordinary success attended their first efforts throughout all Italy. Designed for the common people, the order found equal acceptance from princes and nobles. In Parma, the highest families submitted themselves to the spiritual exercises. In Venice, Lainez expounded the Gospel of St. John to a congregation of nobles, and in 1542, a Jesuit college was founded in that city. The citizens of Montepulciano accompanied Francisco Strada through the streets begging. Their chief knocked at the doors, and his followers received the alms. In Faenza, they succeeded in arresting the Protestant movement, which had been commenced by the eloquent Bernardino Occhino, and by the machinery of schools and societies for the relief of the poor, they brought back the population to the papacy. These are but a few instances out of many of their popularity and successes. In the countries of Spain and Portugal, their success was even greater than in Italy. A son of the soil, its founder had breathed the spirit into the order, which spread among the Spaniards like an infection. Some of the highest grandees enrolled themselves in its ranks. In the province of Valencia, the multitudes that flocked to hear the Jesuit preacher, Eros, were such that no cathedral would contain them, and a pulpit was erected for him in the open air. From the city of Salamanca, where in 1548 they had opened their establishment in a small, wretched house, the Jesuits spread themselves all over Spain. Two members of the society were sent to the King of Portugal at his own request. The one he retained as his confessor, the other he dispatched to the East Indies. This was that Francis Xavier who there gained for himself, says Ranke, the name of an apostle and the glory of a saint. At the courts of Madrid and Lisbon, they soon acquired immense influence. They were the confessors of nobles and the counselors of the monarch. The Jesuits found it more difficult to force their way into France. Much they wished to found a college in that city where their first vow had been recorded, but every attempt was met by the determined opposition of the Parliament and the clergy, who were jealous of their enormous privileges. The wars between the Guises and the Huguenots at length opened a door for them. Lainez, who by this time had become their general, saw his opportunity, and in 1561 succeeded in effecting his object, although on condition of renouncing the peculiar privileges of the order and submitting to episcopal jurisdiction. The promise was made, but with a mental reservation, which removed the necessity of keeping it. They immediately founded a college in Paris, open schools which were taught by clever teachers, and planted Jesuit seminaries at Avignon, Rhodes, Lyon, and other places. Their intrigues kept the nation divided and much inflamed the fury of the civil wars. Henry III was assassinated by one of their agents. They next attempted the life of Henry IV. This crime led to their first banishment from France in 1594. But soon they crept back into the kingdom in the guise of traitors and operatives. They were at last openly admitted by the monarch, a service which they repaid by slaughtering him in the streets of his capital. Under their rule, France continued to bleed and agonize, to plunge from woe into crime, and from crime into woe, to the crowning wickedness of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes laid the country prostrate. It lay quiet for more than half a century till, recovering somewhat from its exhaustion, it lifted itself up only to encounter the terrible blow of its great revolution. We turn to Germany. Here it was that the Church of Rome had suffered her first great losses. Here, under the arms of the Jesuits, she was destined to make a beginning of those victories which recovered not a little of the ground she had lost. A generation had passed away since the rise of Protestantism. It is the year 1550. The sons of the men who had gathered round Luther occupy the stage when the van of this great invading host makes its appearance. They come in silence. They are plain in their attire, humble and submissive in their deportment. But behind them are the stakes and scaffolds of the persecutor and the armies of France and Spain. Their quiet words find terrible reverberations in those awful tempests of war which for 30 years desolated Germany. Ferdinand I of Austria, reflecting on the decay into which the Roman Catholic feeling had fallen in Germany, sent to Ignatius Loyola for a few zealous teachers to instruct the youth of his dominions. In 1551, 13 Jesuits, including Leger, arrived in Vienna. They were provided with pensions, placed in the university chairs, and crept upwards until they seized the entire direction of that seminary. From that hour dates the crimes and misfortunes of the House of Austria. A little colony of disciples of Loyola had, before this, planted itself at Cologne. It was not till some years that they took root in that city, but the initial difficulties surmounted, they began to effect a change in public sentiment, which went on until Cologne became, as it is sometimes called, the Rome of the North. About the same time, the Jesuits became flourishing in Ingolstadt. They had been driven away on their first entrance into that university seat, the professors dreading them as rivals, but in 1556 they were recalled and soon rose to influence, as was to be expected in a city where the memory of Dr. Eck was still fresh. Their battles, less noisy than his, were fated to accomplish much more for the papacy. From these three centers, Vienna, Cologne, and Ingolstadt, the Jesuits extended themselves over all Germany. They established colleges in the chief cities for the sons of princes and nobles, and they opened schools in town and village for the instruction of the lower classes. From Vienna, they distributed their colonies throughout the Austrian dominions. They had schools in the Tyrol and the cities at the foot of its mountains. From Prague, they ramified over Bohemia and penetrated into Hungary. Their colleges at Ingolstadt and Munich gave them the possession of Bavaria, Franconia, and Swabia. From Cologne, they extended their convents and schools over Rhenish Prussia and planted a college at Spires. They counteracted the influence of the Heidelberg University, then the resort of the most learned men of the German nation. Wherever the Jesuits appeared, there was quickly seen a manifest revival of the popish faith. In the short space of 10 years, their establishments had flourished in all the countries in which they were planted. Their system of education was adapted to all classes. While they studied the exact sciences and strove to rival the most renowned of the Protestant professors and so draw the higher youth into their schools, they compiled admirable catechisms for the use of the poor. They especially excelled as teachers of Latin, and so great was their zeal and their success that even Protestants removed their children from distant schools to place them under the care of the Jesuits. The teachers seldom failed to inspire the youth in their schools with their own devotion to the popish faith. The sons of Protestant fathers were drawn to confession, and by into general conformity to popish practices. Food which the church had forbidden, they would not touch on interdicted days, although it was being freely used by other members of the family. They also began to distinguish themselves by the use of popish symbols. The wearing of crosses and rosaries is recorded by Ranke as one of the first signs of the setting of the tide towards Rome. Forgotten rites began to be revived. Relics which had been thrown aside and buried in darkness were sought out and exhibited to the public gaze. The old virtue returned into rotten bones, and the holiness of faded garments flourished anew. The saints of the church came out in bold relief, while those of the Bible receded into the distance. The light of candles replaced the word of life in the temples. The newest fashions of worship were imported from Italy, and music and architecture in the style of the Restoration were called in to reinforce the movement. Customs which had not been witnessed since the days of their grandfathers began to receive the reverent observance of the new generation. In the year 1560, the youth of Ingolstadt, belonging to the Jesuit school, walked two by two on a pilgrimage to Eichstätt in order to be strengthened for their confirmation by the dew that dropped from the tomb of St. Walpurgis. The modes of thought and feeling thus implanted in the schools were, by means of preaching and confession, propagated through the whole population. While the Jesuits were busy in the seminaries, the Pope operated powerfully in the political sphere. He had recourse to various arts to gain over the princes. Duke Albert V of Bavaria had a grant made him of one-tenth of the property of the clergy. This riveted his decision on the side of Rome. And he now set himself with earnest zeal and marked success to restore, in its ancient purity and vigor, the popery of his territories. The Jesuits lauded the piety of the Duke, who was a second Josias, a new Theodosius. The Pope saw clearly that they could never hope to restore the ancient discipline and rule of their church without the help of the temporal sovereigns. Beside Duke Albert, who so powerfully contributed to reestablish the sway of Rome over all Bavaria, the ecclesiastical princes who governed so large a part of Germany threw themselves heartily into the work of restoration. The Jesuit Canisius, a man of blameless life and consummate address, and whose great zeal was regulated by an equal prudence, was sent to counsel and guide them. Under his management, they accepted provisionally the edicts of the Council of Trent. They required of all professors and colleges to subscribe to a confession of the popish faith. They exacted the same pledge from ordinary schoolmasters and medical practitioners in many parts of Germany. No one could follow a profession till first he had given public proof of his orthodoxy. Bishops were required to exercise a more vigilant superintendence of their clergy than they had done these 20 past years. The Protestant preachers were banished, and in some parts, the entire Protestant population was driven out. The Protestant nobles were forbidden to appear at court. Many withdrew into retirement, but others purchased their way back by renunciation of their faith. By these and similar arts, Protestantism was conquered on what may be regarded as its native soil. If not wholly rooted up, it maintained henceforward but a languishing existence. Its leaf faded, and its fruit died in the noxious air around it, while Romanism shot up in fresh strength and robustness. A whole century of calamity followed the entrance of the Jesuits into Germany. The troubles they excited culminated at last in the Thirty Years' War. For the space of a generation, the thunder of battle continued to roll over the fatherland. But the God of their fathers had not forsaken the Germans. It pleased him to summon, from the distant Sweden, Gustavus Adolphus, and by his arm to save the remnants a Protestant liberty in that country. Thus, the Jesuits failed in their design of subjugating the whole of Germany and had to content themselves with dominating over those portions, unhappily large, of which the ecclesiastical princes had given them possession at first. And in our next segment, we're going to jump into Chapter 9. That is the commercial enterprises and banishments, how the Jesuits wormed their way even in to business and commercial enterprise. Okay, we'll see you back for that. Looks like in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ." This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Available for your Apple, Android device, and smartphone, absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today, so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.